Hey there. I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you. An alleged war criminal from Syria has been arrested in L.A. He'd been living here in the U.S. for years.
Google his picture, reverse image his photo, and he comes up shaking hands with Assad.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. That story, as well as the history of spying in U.S.-China relations.
They want to be the big power in Asia eventually, replacing the U.S. And to do that, they need a sophisticated espionage program.
Plus, a Palestinian Christian pastor in Brooklyn doesn't avoid talking about the conflict in Gaza.
And one ingredient in a Trader Joe's spice mix got it banned in South Korea.
South Korea classes poppy seeds as a narcotic product.
So much for bagels.
That's ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday. U.S. authorities made a significant arrest in a Los Angeles airport yesterday. They detained a man by the name of Samir Usman al-Sheikh, who was waiting to board a plane to Beirut.
Al-Sheikh is a former Syrian government official accused of torturing and killing political dissidents in his home country. He had been living in L.A. since 2020, somehow staying under the radar despite his high profile. Muaz Mustafa played a key role in locating Al-Sheikh. He leads a Syrian NGO in Washington. Before getting to how Samir Usman al-Sheikh was apprehended, Mustafa explained why he was wanted in the first place.
I think this is a huge arrest. This person, before the Syrian revolution began, was actually a senior intelligence officer with the Assad regime, someone who ran Adra civilian prison that's located on the outskirts of Damascus. And during his time there, he did terrible things, oversaw and signed off on executions, watched people be tortured in front of him in his own office, did some really, really horrible stuff. Assad himself pulled him out of retirement in order to appoint him as both the governor of Deir ez-Zor and the head of the security committee there.
The governor of the Syrian province you're talking about.
That's right. The Syrian governorate of Deir ez-Zor, which is, you know, on the border with Iraq. And this was a place in 2011 when he was appointed that had been coming out in a peaceful protest against the tyrannical regime in Damascus. And then it was this man who was responsible for the detention of countless people from Deir ez-Zor. And he ordered the Syrian regime's army to shell and besiege and bombard Deir ez-Zor. So his time from 2011 to 2013 in Deir ez-Zor was even bloodier than his time heading a concentration camp like Adra prison.
There are a lot of, you know, very serious allegations here, but he has not yet been convicted of any of these crimes. Is that right?
Yeah, he's been arrested on a couple of charges and he's under investigation for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and for every man, woman, child, and elderly person who he ordered their arrest or shot by allowing people to shoot at the peaceful protest.
You've mentioned that your organization was involved in this case. You mentioned evidence that you helped gather. What role did your organization play in this arrest?
Yeah, so our team gets a call. We understand that this war criminal is actually in the United States. And so what we do is we went to work right away. We went and reported this to the Department of State, to Near East Affairs, to the Bureau for Democracy, Labor, and Human Rights. This is all within the State Department. Told some key folks in Congress that can, you know, help us push things through. And then most importantly, talk to law enforcement in the Department of Justice. And so once we informed the U.S. government, we were able to provide them information of where this guy was in the United States or where he is right now and where he was before. And then it began an investigation. The arrest was going to be whenever we have had multiple, you know, cases already built. But when he bought a one-way ticket to leave, the arrest had to take place.
So Samir Usman al-Sheikh has allegedly committed these crimes, you know, on Syrian soil. How will a court case against him in the U.S. work? How will he be processed through the courts here?
Yeah, so look, different countries have different laws in different jurisdictions. Under U.S. code, if the perpetrator is here in the United States, then it's a whole other story. And there's precedent for this. And so because he happened to come to the United States, it doesn't matter if he holds American citizenship or not. It doesn't matter if he's killed or tortured an American citizen or not. He can be held accountable because he came to our country under our jurisdiction. He'll be held accountable for crimes against humanity or war crimes or torture or anything terrible he's done.
Now, Al-Sheikh was a permanent resident in the U.S. He had a green card. He was well along the path toward citizenship. You know, the U.S. is not an easy place to gain citizenship for most immigrants. I'm wondering, you know, with this high-profile past, how exactly did he get so far along the path toward citizenship? Do you know?
I'm wondering the exact same thing. I have the greatest respect and you know, for the professionalism of U.S. government workers and CBP and all of that, you know, and whoever reads over a visa and so on. But I think here there's either a mistake or something else. And the fact that someone, I mean, Google his picture, reverse image his photo, and he comes up shaking hands with Assad.
Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria.
But look, at the end of the day, I'm not mad about that, honestly, because if he didn't reach the United States, we wouldn't be able to hold him accountable. But that is another conversation that needs to be addressed in all seriousness, is how can war criminals be allowed in or out? And that's how every single person from the Assad regime or any war criminal should feel about coming to the United States.
You mentioned that this is a meaningful arrest globally, not just for the U.S. There have been efforts to prosecute former Syrian regime officials and military figures in Europe and other places. How exactly do you place this case within that larger context?
I think this is the biggest case out there. Look, I love that there is a red notice out of France for Bashar al-Assad himself. And I think more countries should actually come together in like a joint court or joint investigation to where they can put out red notices, arrest warrants for Bashar al-Assad himself that won't be challenged in court, you know, because a single country alone can't just go after the president of another country. There's some ICJ precedent, among other things. And you see that problem playing out in France. But the other thing is, this is the United States itself taking that role. And I don't know if the United States has arrested someone on this level from Syria ever. I think this is big news on multiple levels. Most importantly for me, it is hope for the Syrian revolution and the Syrian people that continue to fight for their dignity. And it's fear for the dictator in Damascus.
Muaz Mustafa is the executive director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force. He joined us from Washington.
Luxury cars, gold bars, and thousands of dollars in cash stuffed into boots. These were some of the damning details that led to yesterday's conviction of U.S. Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey. He is now the first U.S. senator to be found guilty of acting as an agent of a foreign power. He was also found guilty of extortion and bribery among 16 total charges. Prosecutors said Menendez took bribes from the Egyptian government between 2018 to 2022, and in return, the senator used his position to push for more arms and aid to go to Egypt. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on reaction to his case.
Menendez wasn't taking these bribes directly. According to federal prosecutors, three Egyptian-American businessmen gave them to his wife, Nadine, to influence the senator. The businessmen had connections with Egyptian intelligence. Jody Vittori is a retired U.S. Air Force intelligence officer who worked on NATO's counter-corruption task force in Afghanistan. She says lobbying on behalf of foreign governments happens all the time in Washington, but this is not your typical lobbying.
This was not done openly through various campaign finance laws and transparency laws. Instead, this was done secretly.
Vittori, who now teaches at Georgetown University, says Egypt has a bleak human rights record, and that's why aid and weapons to the country were held up at the time.
This is about ultimately items that are exported from the United States that have lethal purposes. This isn't like a normal export of bulldozers or something like that. These are arms. These are some of the most important items that we export and some of the most controlled items that we export.
Hisham Qassem used to chair Egypt's Organization for Human Rights. He says the U.S. and Egypt have always had a primarily military connection. Egypt borders Gaza and was the first Arab nation to recognize the State of Israel. It also has signed a peace treaty with Israel. Qassem says since former General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi took power in 2013, there has been a major crackdown on freedom of speech in his country that extends to coverage of Menendez's trial.
Basically, the Sisi regime has full control over media now. So very little or almost non-existent coverage was given to the matter.
Qasem has experienced Egypt's media censorship firsthand. He was a publisher of Misr al-Youm, an English language and independent newspaper.
Everybody thought I was crazy to launch an English language weekly in Cairo, and it did very well for 7 years. And in the end, I had to shut it down because they were targeting my advertisers.
Qasem has been a critic of President Sisi, frequently exposing corruption and repression in Egypt. Last year, as he was about to launch a new political party, he was arrested and sentenced to 6 months in prison. He was released in February after serving his time. He says he's not at all surprised that Sisi and his officials bribed an American senator, and that despite the media silence in Egypt, the news is being noticed.
Now, with the verdict, I see it's hitting social media very quickly, and there is a sense of anger in Egypt now with the failure of the regime to deliver and the hardship that everybody is being exposed to, in addition to the attempt to control and cut any criticism to the regime.
Meanwhile, back in the U.S., those who have been critical of arms transfer to repressive countries see yesterday's verdict as a success. Josh Paul is one of them. He worked at the State Department and for about a decade helped send American weapons overseas.
I think there are a lot of people in government who are concerned by corruption and will do what they can to address it where the law allows.
Last fall, Paul resigned from his position as the director of the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs. That was in protest to the Biden administration's military assistance to Israel. He says the Justice Department asked him to testify in the Menendez case, which he did. Paul says while this case was exceptional, that it resulted in the conviction of a sitting U.S. senator, it does point to a broader problem of foreign influence in the U.S.
You know, our laws about corruption are very narrowly tailored. So if you receive, you know, gold bars and hide them in the pockets of your jacket, that is one thing. But if you receive millions of dollars in campaign contributions, that is another.
In response to the verdict, Menendez said yesterday that he will appeal. He denied having ever been an agent of any foreign government. He will be sentenced in October and potentially faces decades in prison. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The grocery store Trader Joe's has this seasoning blend, everything but the bagel. It makes anything you put it on taste like an everything bagel. I am a fan, like a lot of people here in the U.S. and also apparently in South Korea.
But it was outlawed there 2 years ago, and then this happened.
An ex-user recently posted a photo of a sign at Seoul's Incheon Airport specifically warning visitors that the much-beloved seasoning blend is not allowed past security.
There's a reason for that.
South Korea classes poppy seeds as a narcotic product.
Michelle Carlin teaches toxicology and forensic chemistry at Rutgers University Camden in New Jersey.
Poppy seeds have been shown to have opiate compounds like morphine and codeine on their surface, and that's probably why they've included poppy seeds as a narcotic.
Of course, the narcotic qualities of the poppy plant are legendary.
Now, my beauty, something with poison in it, I think.
The Wicked Witch of the West used poppies to take Dorothy and her friends out of commission near the Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz.
Poppies will put them to sleep.
And poppy seeds can carry measurable amounts of opiates, as the character Elaine discovered in an episode of Seinfeld.
Well, this you're not going to believe. I found out why I was testing positive for opium. Poppy seeds!
Poppy seeds!
And there's something to that.
I wouldn't eat them if I knew that I was participating and had agreed to participate in workplace drug testing.
Professor Carlin says a poppy seed muffin, for example, will not get you high and is not a health hazard.
If, however, we were looking at recipes in Eastern Europe or in parts of Germany where they use poppy seed paste, or it might be something like poppy seed tea, then the chances are higher because you've concentrated the amount of opiates that are present.
She says that poppy seeds on top of a pastry lose their potency when they're baked.
As for the seasoning mix that's caused controversy in South Korea, here's a pro tip from the toxicologist.
As long as you're not eating a whole bottle of either poppy seeds or everything but the bagel, if you use it in moderation, then you should be fine.
Just don't take poppy seed snacks on a flight to South Korea.
Coming up, is there more COVID around this summer? You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Summer in the U.S. means hot weather, vacations, if you're lucky. And for the past 4 years, COVID. We asked Andrew Pakosh at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to help us understand what COVID looks like this summer.
What we've seen in the last couple of weeks is, particularly in the U.S. and specifically in the Southwest United States, we've really seen a significant increase in both COVID-positive cases as well as in emergency room visits and hospitalizations with COVID. We've usually seen surges start in sort of August and go into September. So it's really not clear why we're seeing that in certain parts of the country, but also not in others.
And what about the rest of the Northern Hemisphere right now? Are we also seeing a spike in places like Europe or elsewhere where it's summer?
Yeah, no, in other places, we're not seeing a very significant spike in cases. Right now, there are some cases in Southeast Asia, and that is probably the region that has the most number of cases outside of the Southwest United States.
So the U.S. is seeing a spike when not a lot of other places are. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So is there a theory about why this is happening here in the U.S. earlier in the summer than usual and seemingly somewhat unique in the Northern Hemisphere?
We don't think it's anything to do with the variants that are circulating, because if you look, all the same variants are pretty much circulating across the U.S. The one thing people are pointing to is the fact that, you know, with the extreme heat that much of the country has been under, that tends to drive people back indoors. And, you know, while summer is not the best time for respiratory viruses to spread outdoors, you know, when people move back inside, when they congregate together in small spaces, when they've got fans and air conditioners running at high blast, that represents an environment that could be a little bit more conducive, right, to respiratory virus spread. So it may be that this large heat wave that we've been suffering is secondarily causing this surge in COVID cases.
Could it possibly be that in Europe we're not seeing the same spike because there is less air conditioning there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of the things that you really want to look for when people move indoors is not only that people are more crowded in smaller spaces, but you also need to look at airflow. If airflow is moving sort of horizontally, right, side to side in a room, that's much more dangerous for spread of respiratory viruses, because a person who's infected may be able to put virus into the air and that gets moved sideways to where other people are. And again, the hotter the temperature, sometimes the higher the fans are, the higher the air circulation is. And so you just sort of amplify those conditions that are a little bit better for respiratory virus spread.
So in a place where people might be opening the windows and having more ventilation to cool, the risk of indoor spread might be lower than a place where there's a lot more air conditioning and that is the cooling solution.
Yeah.
What should we know about the current variant circulating? I'm hearing a lot about one called Flirt, which I am assuming sounds a lot more fun than it actually is.
The F and the L and the R and the T both represent changes or mutations that the virus has in certain regions. So by adding the little I in between, they've made it a really catchy name. But there is a little science behind that name. The important thing about those variants are they've picked up a few mutations that will help evade your vaccine or your prior infection-induced immunity, so therefore more people will be susceptible to infection with those variants. They've also improved their ability to bind to the cells in your body that they want to infect, so that also may make transmission a little bit easier. So we expect that these variants are better at transmitting, but we haven't seen any signal so far that they're causing more severe disease or any change in symptoms from prior variants.
Andrew Pakosh is a virologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Latinos make up a small slice of the population in North Carolina, but they're expected to play a key role in U.S. elections this November. The Biden campaign is using Spanish-language media to reach Latino voters in the state. Meanwhile, a conservative nonprofit called the Libre Initiative is playing the long game to nudge voters in the opposite direction. WFAE's Steve Harrison reports from Chapel Hill.
One Friday afternoon this month, about a dozen volunteers and staff of the Libre Initiative met in a university city office. They were going door knocking the next day, and Cecilia Navas was giving them their assignments. The next day, two paid staffers are driving their red Jeep through Blakeney and South Charlotte. One is Nico Goldstein, whose mom is from Ecuador and whose father is from Israel. The other is Gerardo Lora, a U.S. military retiree who was originally from the Dominican Republic. They have a list of Latino voters.
Hola, ¿cómo está, caballero? Buenas tardes.
it's hard work and heat well past 90 degrees. Most people aren't home. Some don't want to talk. Finally, there's a win. An elderly man in a townhome with a Virgin Mary statue in his garden.
Le estaba diciendo que en términos generales, ¿cuál de estos temas es más importante para usted? ¿La educación, la inflación o la atención sanitaria?
Creo que la inflación, realmente.
Okay. Afterward, Goldstein and Laura explain how it went. In response to a question about what is the man's biggest concern, education, inflation, or healthcare?
His was inflation, so that prompted questions on what his opinion.
That's very common. As yeah, well too. That's very common.
Oh yeah, the inflation. Like, everyone's dying to get their opinion on what inflation's yeah. impacting them.
Goldstein is reading the questionnaire from his phone. Depending on what answer the person gives, Goldstein is given a new question to ask.
So the next question was like, if he supports increasing taxes or government spending to try to fix the economy, even if it causes inflation. I think he said no, right? Then the prompt asked him about healthcare questions, like who he thinks should have most say in decisions that affect the type of healthcare he gets, his family or the government. He chose his family.
The questions don't mention Biden or Trump. They don't encourage someone to vote one way or the other. And in this survey, at least, they don't even talk about the election. What Libre is doing is trying to identify Latinos who are predisposed to center-right political ideas and to get them engaged with meetups and seminars. The hope is that as Latinos increasingly flex their political muscle, they turn out to be a conservative bloc, not part of the Democratic coalition like strategists often assume they will be.
This year and even last year, the top priority that we heard from the community was the economy.
That's Jeffrey Baldwin, strategic director for the Libre Initiative in North Carolina. He immigrated to the United States from Guatemala when he was 14.
And that's what we are doing, several events across the state about the economy and the topic of Fidenomics.
The Libre Initiative started in 2011 with backing from the conservative benefactors Charles Koch and his late brother David Koch. In the past, Libre opposed Obamacare. It's critical of Biden's economic policies. The group supports school choice and making some immigrants who came to the U.S. illegally citizens. 6 years ago, Nevada Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto criticized Libre.
What the Koch brothers and their web of dark money organizations like Libre are really doing is deceiving Latinos and supporting the very same politicians who are working against Latino families.
This year, former President Trump has not only called for more border security, but to round up and deport between 15 and 20 million people he says are in the country illegally. Despite that rhetoric from Trump, polls show the ex-president has more support among Latino voters than he had in 2020. In North Carolina, the Biden campaign said it's knocking on doors earlier than in previous election cycles, including in Latino communities. For the world, I'm Steve Harrison.
More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World. A Palestinian Christian pastor who leads a church in Brooklyn gets questions.
When people ask me, when did you convert to Christianity, I always look at my watch and say, 2,000 years ago on the day of Pentecost. And I always remind people that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, my hometown.
The story of a de facto ambassador ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Every difficult conflict or tense relationship on the planet draws in politicians, diplomats, and military leaders. They debate and predict what could and should happen next. Underlying their official efforts is a more secretive one, espionage. This summer, we're examining the competitive tension between the U.S. and China with veteran journalist Jane Perlez, host of the podcast Face Off, the U.S. versus China. Today, how the long arc of spycraft has shifted the balance between these two powers. Here's Jane.
It's November 1952. The U.S. is 5 years into the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and the anti-communist rhetoric is hot.
It is not an American political party like any other. They are lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, murderous, determined. It's an international criminal conspiracy.
Also heating up, the Korean War. In the midst of this red paranoia, two young CIA agents, John Downey and Richard Fecteau, take off in a plane from Japan towards northern China. Their mission? Bring home a Chinese operative who had been working for the CIA inside newly communist China. Downey and Fecteau would not be seen again for 20 years. The plan was crazy. John Downey and Richard Fecteau were to swoop over Chinese territory in a plane, never land, but literally hook the Chinese CIA operative to a long table and then fly away.
They'd come in about 50 feet off the ground with the poles extended from the plane.
This is Richard Fecteau recounting the rescue attempt in a CIA documentary.
And we'd pick him up, he would be jolted off the ground, and then we'd just reel him in. I was running the machine, so right off the back, no problem.
But there were problems. The Chinese CIA operative who had requested the pickup had outed the CIA officers. Downey and Fecteau were flying into a trap. Their plane was shot down by Chinese soldiers.
All that the CIA and the U.S. government knows after that night is that the plane doesn't come back.
John DeLury is the author of the book Agents of Subversion.
When they try to assess what's going on, come to pretty much the same conclusion, which is, oh, the plane must have crashed somewhere and everyone died on board, but we don't have anything to worry about. Clearly, the Chinese didn't capture the plane or shoot it down.
But in fact, Downey and Fecteau are captured and imprisoned for nearly 20 years.
This case brings you right to the heart of the problem in U.S.-China relations up until 1972, which is the two sides do not talk. They don't talk, and they do not understand one another.
The breakthrough in their release finally comes in the early 70s, when Nixon opens up U.S.-China relations. After decades in prison, Downey and Fecteau quietly return to their normal lives in the United States. Fast forward to today.
The great irony here is how the tables have turned and how the United States now has to play defense in terms of the intelligence relationship with China in a way historically it didn't have to. China's had to play defense against the United States from day one.
This has the U.S. intelligence agencies on high alert.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon sitting there on top of maybe a nuclear silo and riveting the whole country for a week. That's just almost a laughable example of what is a well-resourced effort to know their enemy.
A laughable example, perhaps, but as we're about to hear, the spy game between the U.S. and China is no laughing matter. That was reporting by Jane Perlez, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times, in an excerpt from her podcast, Face Off, the U.S. versus China. Jane, welcome back to The World.
Good to be here, Marco.
So two examples of spycraft you gave there, a dramatic case from the 50s and that memorable spy balloon from last year. Let's split the difference and go to the 1980s, when China is forming its modern spy agency. Tell us how the Ministry of State Security worked back then.
Talking about China and its espionage is a hot topic in D.C. now, particularly around the question of what China might be doing inside the U.S. So it's worthwhile going back to the 80s. China then was still poor, but it was determined to grow. So it founded the Ministry of State Security, popularly known as the MSS. The overarching goal of the CCP, we should remember, is for China to be a global power. By CCP, I mean the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
And if not the global power, at least at first the power in Asia. And to get there, they decided they really needed a good intel operation. So they established a system where the job was decentralized by forming bureaus of state security in different parts of China. So, for example, the Shanghai State Security Bureau and the Jiangsu State Security Bureau focused on spying on the U.S. Sounds a bit strange to us, but that's the way they did it.
Mm.
And state security bureaus in other parts of the country focused on Japan and others on Europe. It was quite a federated system. At the same time, the authorities in China began to rely on the Chinese diaspora abroad. They were telling Chinese in the US and Britain, for example, they had it easy in such developed countries, and they owed it to the motherland to do work for them. This cultivation of diaspora was done over a fairly long period and produced excellent results. Not everybody in the diaspora, I really want to add, accepted the call. Far from it. But by relying on the diaspora quite a lot, China didn't really need to recruit foreigners. They could rely on Chinese living abroad.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You report the U.S. also was relying on Chinese citizens as part of its own espionage against China, and with some pretty devastating consequences for those individuals, right?
Yeah, for those individuals, for sure. Yes, in 2010-12, the U.S. suffered a huge intel failure inside China. Suddenly, it discovered all its assets inside China had dried up. They couldn't be found. The U.S. had paid these assets, by the way, quite well, so they could bribe their way to promotions inside important Chinese agencies. And the U.S. was getting good intel from these assets. But maybe as many as 20 U.S. assets inside China were executed or imprisoned in that period, 2010 to 2012. It was a terrible time for them, obviously, and it left a black hole in U.S. understanding what was going on at the top of China. It's a black hole that goes on to this day, of course, because the Chinese Communist Party at the top is as opaque as you can get. And the U.S. understanding of what goes on behind the thick curtain of secrecy is not helped by the disappearance of all those human assets.
Right. A really awful intelligence failure with deadly consequences. Now, you spoke with a person who is unusually well-placed to understand these competing spy efforts, Nigel Inkster. He was the director of operations at Britain's MI6 and was based in Beijing. He told you that Iran had a role in outing those people spying for the U.S. and China.
My best appreciation of what did happen was that a covert communication used by the CIA with an Iranian asset had been compromised. The Iranians shared the intelligence of that covert communications system with the Chinese and almost certainly with the Russians as well.
Jane, did Inkster's knowledge surprise you?
Well, first thing to say is Nigel Inkster is as good as they come when it comes to understanding Chinese intelligence. His comments about Iran on our podcast did not really surprise me, because China had been cultivating Iran for quite a while.
China still does have a practice of recruiting Chinese Americans to spy on its behalf. You may take issue with the word recruiting as too soft a word. You report there is coercion involved.
We see this with Chinese Americans who want to work and serve their country, the United States, by the way, at the State Department. There are reports that hundreds of people who want to work at State are being held up from gaining full employment because their clearances are held up on the grounds China might want to take advantage of them. Here's what Nigel Inkster told me.
The reality is that ethnic Chinese U.S. nationals who want to serve in the government for all the right reasons will be looked at very hard by the Chinese intelligence services when they go to China. And of course, if they do have relatives within China or other personal connections, it is to be expected that the Chinese intelligence services will seek to utilize those connections. They're getting harder edged and more ruthless about doing this. It's not just something that applies to, you know, State Department employees. It applies also, you know, to members of the Chinese diaspora who go overseas for limited periods and then find themselves coming under pressure, often through relatives, to do things for the Chinese state.
You know, we should say that some of these applicants to the State Department do have relatives back in China, and Chinese intelligence may punish these people who live in China because their relatives are in the U.S. But the State Department and other U.S. agencies can't discriminate against applicants based on race. So it's a bit of everybody's caught in a bit of a bind.
And we have seen this reverberate with accusations at U.S. universities as well, sometimes falsely, against Chinese citizens and Chinese Americans. Jane, at the start of our conversation, we mentioned the Chinese spy balloon incidents last year, balloons spotted between January and February that were hovering over the U.S. It caught a lot of attention, some of it lighthearted and incredulous, some of it serious and worrying. What did those incidents reveal to you?
Well, I think mainly that incident revealed that the American public and Congress were blown away by the idea that a Chinese balloon with possible espionage capabilities was parked over the United States for some days. I think it really blew a lot of people's minds. How sophisticated that balloon was is up for debate, I think. But the bottom line is that the balloon did have equipment that helped China know more about U.S. bases in the Asia-Pacific region. But the important point about where China's espionage is going is this. China is a high-tech nation, just as the U.S. is a high-tech nation. Both are capable of espionage like never before. So the Chinese are determined, and they want to be, at the very least, to be the big power in Asia eventually, replacing the U.S. And to do that, they need a sophisticated espionage program. As Inkster said in our podcast, the Chinese can do scale that matters. That really matters. FBI Director Wray told Congress recently that China can just outnumber the U.S. on any given problem.
Mm. There is news now that there are Chinese listening stations in Cuba that are ready, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, ready to scoop up a treasure trove of U.S. intelligence. I mean, one wonders if the U.S. has a parallel undertaking. I'm just wondering what you make of those spy stations in Cuba. And do you foresee this intelligence gathering only getting more aggressive by both sides?
Well, I don't find it surprising at all that China has listening stations on Cuba. Cuba's just too close. It's too tempting for America's adversaries. It's a mere 100 miles off the shore. So it turns out that China struck a deal with Cuba in 2019 for listening posts from which they can monitor U.S. electronic communications at U.S. military bases across the South. There are several big U.S. military bases across the South which are useful for the Chinese to spy on. Mm. I think Washington tried to blunt the Chinese relationship with Cuba back in 2014 when Obama opened relations with Cuba, but clearly that hasn't worked terribly well. So the Chinese will just continue to try to get intel gathering operations ever closer to the U.S. I don't know the details, but from the American side, it's pretty good bet that the U.S. has similar capacities on Taiwan, the self-governed island off China, which the United States backs. Remember, Taiwan is just about 100 miles off the coast of China, providing the U.S. with pretty good access to the mainland.
That's veteran journalist Jane Perlez, host of the podcast Face Off, the U.S. versus China. Listen wherever you listen to podcasts. Jane is with us throughout the summer to share more of her reporting.
California is in the middle of an ambitious plan to offer what it calls transitional kindergarten to every four-year-old in the state, addressing the dilemma for kids who just missed the age cutoff for standard kindergarten. It's on track to be the largest free preschool program in the country. Many of the kids expected to enroll are dual language learners. KQED's Daisy Nguyen reports on the challenges California faces as it tries to add a whole new grade level to its sprawling public school system.
Teacher Cynthia Valdivia starts the day in the TK classroom at International Community Elementary School with circle time in Spanish. 20 kids sit on the rug with their legs crossed and sing back to her. Valdivia leads classroom activities in Spanish the rest of the morning, and then her co-teacher Sophie Seibert takes over.
After lunch, it's cambiando a inglés, like we all switch over and practice our English.
Seibert says her students used to dread this moment. Most are children of immigrants from Latin American countries, and they're still more comfortable in Spanish.
A lot of my students are, oh, pues si no entiendo inglés, ¿por qué inglés? And I share, like, well, because you can use your eyes to look at the pictures I'll show you. You can ask your friends for help. We can watch my hand gestures.
But by the end of the year, she says they pass their assessments with flying colors. This classroom model is part of the state's effort to boost bilingual education. In California, some 60% of children under the age of 6 live in homes where a language other than English is spoken. Research shows dual language learners benefit the most from a year of transitional kindergarten. When they get to kindergarten, they're ahead of their peers on math and literacy.
You know, sometimes we hear, oh, if they want to learn English, we need to get them in English classrooms. But actually, the opposite is true.
Caroline Krelot advocates for dual language TK programs at Early Edge California.
If children have a very strong foundation in their home language, they actually learn English more easily.
School districts offer transitional kindergarten classes in Korean, Armenian, and other languages that reflect their community's diversity. It wasn't always this way. In 1998, the state restricted bilingual education in public schools. Then in 2016, voters overturned that policy. But Krolat says the English-only law drained the pool of bilingual teachers, and now the state has a lot of catching up to do.
These few years, it's been a challenge trying to get teachers back into the classroom and then also to get new bilingual teachers to fill these classrooms.
The state invested $25 million to grow the bilingual teacher workforce. There's also a big need for transitional kindergarten teachers, because by next fall, the law will require an adult for every 10 students in the classroom. Oakland Unified is partnering with a local college to recruit teachers and offer financial aid to train its existing staff to teach TK. Seibert came to this classroom after getting an emergency permit through the district. While she earns her credential, she works side by side with a co-teacher and an aide. She says that gives her a chance to hone her teaching skills and provide one-on-one support to students.
We're focusing in this room and in our TK classroom to just expand the joy, expand the capacity for joy and curiosity and learning.
She knows she's fortunate. Other school districts still don't have the staff they need. Last year, the state fined 20 school districts and 50 charter schools for understaffing TK classrooms. For The World, I'm Daisy Nguyen, Oakland, California.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Redeemer St. John's Lutheran Church in Brooklyn, New York is a congregation led by a Palestinian pastor, Hadar Halaliah. He's led the evangelical church for a decade as one of the few Palestinian Christian faith leaders in the U.S. Halaliah says Americans often assume Palestinians are Muslim.
When people ask me when did you convert to Christianity, I always look at my watch and say, 2,000 years ago on the day of Pentecost. And I always remind people that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, my hometown.
Halaliah is from the West Bank. He came to the U.S. in 2005 to go to divinity school. He speaks to his congregation about the plight of Palestinians. We reached out to him to hear what it's been like to lead a church in the U.S., especially during the past 9 months of war in Gaza.
I was invited by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America to continue my theological education here in the United States. And the goal is to serve the Arab and Middle Eastern community. And I'm serving, yes, at an Anglo congregation, but also we are merging with Salam Arabic Lutheran Church. It is the first Arabic Lutheran congregation in North America. And we will have one congregation with two expressions, English and Arabic.
Oh, interesting.
And our members are excited, you know, to be together as the body of Christ, and the body of Christ always like diverse and unique. And this is who we are now. We're going to become a multicultural, multi-ethnic congregation.
I should point out as well that you experienced a conflict firsthand in the West Bank when you lived there. It came very close to losing your life. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, I came back and I sat at the couch, like a couch potato. And
this was in your home?
Yes, in my hometown in Beit Jala. Yes. And then all of a sudden, like, I heard shooting, and then, like, a bullet passed my ear. And I heard it, and then it hit the picture of Romeo and Juliet that was hanging on the wall. And then we had to lay on the ground, you know, and the shooting lasted for 6 hours, and we had moved from one corner to another. It was a very terrifying experience. At that time, I was protecting my younger brother. He was next to me. And, you know, like, when the shooting stopped, we went outside, and we saw, like, you know, the bullets were made in the United States. So
how do you share an experience like that with your congregants? I mean, given the politics of the moment, because I imagine it can get very charged very quickly.
My people are open-minded. I shared this story in one of my sermons, actually. They are aware of what happened to me growing up in Palestine. I shared, you know, my life growing up under occupation. I talked about, you know, what's happening to Palestinians on a daily basis.
I'm curious if you've noticed any changes in attitudes at your church since October 7th, when this latest conflict between Israel and Hamas started.
People were like shocked to learn about what happened on October 7th, I have to say, but also like they know Gaza been under siege for 15 years, and they've been living in an open-air prison. And basically, the international community did not give a damn about what's happening to the people in Gaza. And your listeners might know, like 60% of the population of Gaza under the age of 18. And what we are witnessing happening there, it's basically pain over pain, displacement over displacement, destruction over destruction. And what's happening now in Gaza is a genocide. And we are funding this genocide. The Biden administration is funding the genocide, and my people are very sympathetic to the family of the Israeli hostages and to those people who got killed on October 7. But also, you know, they want also like to see like Palestinian, you know, have their own self-determination and you know, freedom and live as a human being.
Right now, if you can speak as a Christian Palestinian pastor in the U.S., what is the hardest part of your job?
The hardest part is basically like, yes, I'm a pastor, and part of my job is to provide spiritual and emotional and psychological support. But I can tell you, like, people from the community have been coming to me that they are seeking counseling and guidance and help. And our community is terrified. We are witnessing the rise of hate against Arab and Muslim and Muslim American, and nobody is doing anything to stop this hate, unfortunately. So the hardest part is to be in people's shoes and listen to them and provide emotional, psychological support.
And what do you think is the most satisfying part of the role you've taken on as a pastor and kind of de facto representative of Palestinian people? What's something that you did not expect?
Well, I love my job as a pastor. I see this as a call to preach the word, administer the sacraments, and walk with people. Like, for example, like I'm with 12 youth from my congregation in New Orleans attending the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America youth gathering, doing community service here, but also be together to pray, study and sing and dance and be together. So I love what I'm doing as a pastor.
I'm wondering if there's kind of a cultural side to your role as pastor that you've been able to share with your church, something that distinguishes maybe Palestinian Christianity.
I always say the word marhaba in Arabic, which comes from the Syrian and Aramaic language of early Middle Eastern Christian, and the word marhaba, which means God. God is love. When I hang out with people, you know, I always see people not as stranger alien, but like as part of my family, and this is something unique about the Palestinian culture.
Hadar Halaliyah is a Palestinian Christian pastor at Redeemer St. John's Lutheran Church in Brooklyn, New York.
This is new music from Mali's celebrated singers Amadou and Mariam. The track is called Mogolu. That word in the Bambara language of West Africa means the people. Amadou and Mariam are married. They are both blind, and they've been making music together for more than 30 years. Their distinctive mix of traditional Malian sounds fused with rock and roll.
On Mogolu, we hear Amadou and Mariam's voices channeled through autotune, but the message is pure. They sing about the human connections that emerge when we travel, bringing a message of peace, as Amadou and Mariam have done for years.
And that is The World on this Wednesday. We come to you Monday through Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org. And you can always catch up on shows you miss with our podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.